tonight on The Readout.
So I'm going to go into this trial. I'm going to sit in a freezing cold ice box for 8 hours, 9 hours or so. They took me off the campaign trail. Somebody just told me they'd never sat for such a long period of time in a courthouse before. It's ridiculous. I'm supposed to be in Georgia. I'm supposed to be in New Hampshire.
A chilly and weary Donald Trump back in court for week two of testimony, complaining about his inability to campaign after spending his previous days off from court golfing. Also tonight, Trump's frightening new interview about his sinister plans if he gets back into the White House, including allowing states to monitor women's pregnancies and even send them to prison. Plus, Columbia University is vowing to expel pro-Palestinian protesters now occupying an academic building as campus protests and police crackdowns continue across the country. But we begin tonight with week two of testimony in Donald Trump's hush money election interference trial. For the first time, one of Trump's family members, middle son Eric, joined him in the courtroom along with some of Trump's associates. It also appears that Trump's repeated pleas for his supporters to please come to his aid worked, with a few dozen appearing outside the court. It is unknown if any of those supposed supporters also carry a SAG card. But those may be the only highlights to Trump's day, given what transpired inside the courtroom. Most of the day was spent hearing from Keith Davidson, the former attorney for both Karen McDougal and Stormy Daniels. Davidson is a key player in the scheme and alleged conspiracy to pay off the two women to keep their stories about their alleged sexual encounters with Trump from going public before the 2016 election. The prosecution did not just rely on Davidson's testimony, but also his text messages and emails from that time. Text messages between Davidson and the editor of the National Enquirer, Dylan Howard, detail the deal made with McDougal, beginning with, "I have a blockbuster Trump story." Upon finalizing the agreement, Howard texted Davidson, quote, "We are going to lay it on thick for her." Davidson replied, "Good. Throw in an ambassadorship for me. I'm thinking Isle of Man." Today, Davidson testified that his comment was something of a joke, but he sent it because he knew the deal would help Trump's candidacy. The texts between the two also lay out the impact of Stormy Daniels' reemergence in the days following the October 2016 release of the Access Hollywood tape. Davidson texted Howard on October 8th. "Trump is effed," with Howard responding, "Wave the white flag. It's over, people." The next day, Davidson texted, "Hi, the story is already out there," to which Howard responded, "Yeah, but her talking and taking blank is the final nail in the coffin, but he's effed already." Davidson testified on how Michael Cohen missed deadlines to make the $130,000 payment to Daniels, with Davidson recalling Cohen saying, "What do you expect me to do? My guy's in five effing states today." My guy, of course, referring to Donald Trump. It was then, Davidson claims, that Cohen said he would just pay it himself. And that is how Cohen came to pay out the money by taking out a home equity line of credit. And that also brings us to the other witnesses we heard from this morning who were brought on to authenticate various records. That included continued testimony from one of Cohen's bankers, Gary Farrow, who we started to hear from on Friday. He provided the receipts on how Cohen moved fast and furious less than 2 weeks before the 2016 election to both set up an account and complete the wire transfer to Stormy Daniels with Keith Davidson for the $130,000 in hush money. And that payment could not have come quickly enough, as Davidson also presented emails stating that 10 days prior to that wire transfer and after much delay, Stormy Daniels was going to cancel the settlement agreement altogether. Now, someone may need to tell Trump about all these developments, given that his eyes were closed for extended periods throughout the day, again, creating the appearance that has led to folks calling him Sleepy Don. But before Trump started to reach that slumbered state, he was told by Judge Juan Marchand that he was being held in criminal contempt for violating the gag order with his attacks on the jurors and potential witnesses. While he was only fined $1,000 for each of the 9 violations, Marchand warned in the decision that he would not tolerate further violations of the order and said if necessary and appropriate under the circumstances, he would impose an incarceratory punishment on the former president, meaning jail. When the trial resumes on Thursday, it will begin with another hearing over additional alleged gag order violations by Trump. Joining me now is Paul Butler, former federal prosecutor, Georgetown law professor, and MSNBC legal analyst, and Tony Schwartz, CEO of the Energy Project and co-author of Donald Trump's The Art of the Deal. Thank you both for being here. I'm going to start here at the table with you. Let's start with the gag order, Paul. Fines for now, jail later. Donald, if he keeps violating it, Donald Trump did take down the offending posts. But is $9,000 a real penalty?
No, not for Donald Trump. It's chump change. He has the biggest megaphone of any criminal defendant in U.S. history, and he uses it to disparage witnesses in violation of the gag order. Maybe it makes political sense. He's got to give his followers some reason to believe that these folks like Michael Cohen and Stormy Daniels, who could send him to jail or at least cause him to become a convicted criminal, he's got to give his followers a reason not to believe them. But that's in direct contradiction to what the judge has ordered. Joy, any other defendant who willfully disobeyed nine times, nine contempt sanctions would be sitting under Rikers Island right now. So Donald Trump doesn't think of it this way, but this is yet another example of him being treated differently because he's Donald Trump.
Absolutely. What did you think was the most substantive development today? Keith Davidson testifying. He was, of course, the lawyer who arranged the payments. And also you had the banker finishing his testimony about how quickly Michael Cohen acted to create that LLC to sort of make this sort of pretense of a company to send that money to Stormy Daniels.
So as we have to remind everyone, paying hush money isn't a crime.
Right.
What Donald Trump is charged with is falsifying business records that disguise these hush money payments. He did that 34 times, according to Alvin Bragg. That's a misdemeanor, but gets bumped up to a felony if the purpose of these false business records was to try to commit another crime. Alvin Bragg says those other crimes were state and federal campaign violations and also New York tax laws. What does that mean? It means that Alvin Bragg has to prove that this was all about the campaign. And that's what this witness helped do today. So Mr. Davidson was the lawyer for both Stormy Daniels and Kara McDougal. He testified that all of this was about the campaign. It wasn't, contrary to what Trump wants the jurors to think, about keeping this information from Melania. It wasn't about protecting his family.
Yeah.
He's got text messages and emails to prove it. So ultimately, Michael Cohen's going to come and say the same thing.
Yeah.
What Bragg is hoping is that Michael Cohen will be the kind of most anticlimactic star witness in history because everything that Cohen says, Alvin Bragg wants the jurors to have heard before from other witnesses.
And it's already been coordinated with, you know, physical testimony and not just that, but also text messages, et cetera. Tony, let me bring you in here. What do you make of the fact that Donald Trump did make an adjustment today, seemingly finally having a family member in court with him so that he wouldn't look alone? I remember being in the courtroom. He definitely looked lonely with that empty bench behind him with no family and no one there. And then Secret Service one row back. So he looked really sort of solitary. What do you make of the fact that Eric Trump showed up today?
Well, I imagine the family drew straws and he lost because nobody would want to be there with him. I think it's irrelevant. I think clearly he made that decision the same way he makes every decision, which is how do I want it to look as opposed to what is it really? I don't think having him there affected it one way or the other. His eyes are closed. He appears to be either sleeping or off in some sort of reverie. And the notion that this guy is having to sit there for 9 hours a day or 8 hours a day is such for him a torture that it overshadows everything, Joy, that I think is happening in the trial. This is a man who is demonstrating very clearly why he's not qualified to be president. And meanwhile, if you try to ask yourself the question, what's been a good moment for Trump in this trial? You probably can't come up with one because virtually everything, including all of the testimony today and the fact that he was found to be in contempt, have to militate against him. So I think he is putting on a spectacle.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this, because there is reporting that he's unhappy with Todd Blanche's attorney, who, when I saw him in court, he seemed very fidgety and not confident. He's a former federal prosecutor, actually, is apparently a good prosecutor at the time. But he wants more aggression out of Todd Blanche. He's not happy with the lack of aggression.
Well, you can't win as a lawyer for Trump, particularly when you're losing, particularly when Trump recognizes that this isn't going his way. Whether it was this lawyer or any other lawyer, this is a really tough case to litigate. It's a really difficult argument to make. You've got a client who's almost impossible to keep in his seat. So I think, you know, assessing his performance is kind of irrelevant. I think the issue is that Trump is going to beat up on anybody who's falling short of making him look innocent in a situation in which he is guilty as hell.
Let me play a little bit. So there was an interesting thing that happened, Paul, today. They played some C-SPAN archives. Let me play a little bit of what they showed in court today.
It's a phony deal. I have no idea who these women are. I have no idea. And I think you all know I have no idea because you understand me for a lot of years, okay? When you looked at that horrible woman last night, you said, I don't think so. Whoever she is, wherever she comes from, the stories are total fiction. They're 100% made up. They never happened. They never would happen. They're all horrible lies, all fabrications, and we can't let them change the most important election in our lifetime.
Michael Cohen is a very talented lawyer.
What do you think was the, why did the prosecution play that?
Well, it's Trump's voice in court. This is the first time the jury has actually heard what Donald Trump sounds like and what's he doing. He's lying. So first of all, I don't see how he takes the stand because he's going to be able to be impeached with his lies and with his misconducts. He says he didn't cheat on his wife. And again, that's not a crime. But
right.
If he's making that assertion to try to prove his innocence or at least get the jury to find him not guilty, then the jury's not going to like him very much. Again, if he sticks by that statement, so then he'll be in that classic position where the prosecutor says, well, were you lying then when you said it was a lie, or are you lying now when you said it wasn't a lie? So part of it, again, is to kind of prevent Trump from taking the stand, although in some ways prosecutors would love that
because
then all of this other evidence comes in.
Tony, you know, we know in the past Donald Trump has paid people to show up. I mean, he did pay supporters to show up when he did his, and he paid him $50 to come to his presidential announcement. So he's done that in the past. Today he did have protests. He's been very openly whining that, you know, his protesters can't get in. Like, there was nobody there when I was there except one guy was ringing a bell. He finally did get a little bit of a protest today. Why does he need that?
Well, he needs anything to shore up the sense of inadequacy and emptiness that pervades his body, even outside of his awareness. So anything that could, it's why he wants to go out and give speeches right now, not because he thinks they matter necessarily one way or the other, but because he loves to be beloved. And so I actually thought, and I say this, even as somebody who, you know, notwithstanding the fact that I'm a critic of his, that was a pretty pathetic demonstration in response to being asked, for all Trump supporters being asked to show up at the court. I mean, what was it? 2 or 3 dozen people? Yeah. I mean, these are people who had nothing to do today, but virtually no one did show up. And I find that all fascinating, including the fact that members of his family don't show up. Really, Trump has no emotional connection to anyone, including himself. And so to recognize that we're looking at an extraordinary human being, it's a surreal situation.
Yeah, it is, to say the least. Well said, and even an understatement. Paul Butler, Tony Schwartz, thank you both very much. And up next on The Readout, democracy is in danger if the aforementioned Trump wins. And a terrifying new interview in Time magazine makes that abundantly clear, with Trump threatening to use military force to deport undocumented immigrants, allow red states to monitor women's pregnancies, and much more. The readout continues after this. As a candidate, Donald Trump has had a wide berth to talk a lot without saying much. This morning, Time magazine published a new interview with Trump where they asked him serious probative questions about what a second Trump presidency would actually look like. And it's dark stuff. From a dictatorship only on day one, migrant detention camps, using the Comstock Act to ban abortion, and policing protesters by deploying the National Guard. He told Times reporter that he'd be willing to fire a U.S. attorney who didn't prosecute someone he ordered, noting that it depends on the situation. He explained that obliterating the so-called deep state meant getting rid of bad people, people that have not done a good job for him. He would absolutely pardon criminals convicted of assaulting the Capitol on January 6th, telling Time that many of those people went in, many of those people were ushered in. You see it on tape. The police are ushering them in. They're walking with the police. When the reporter asked Trump what he thought of Americans who found his language about being a dictator for a day or suspending the Constitution contrary to American democracy, he said, "I think a lot of people like it." And much like the last election, when asked if he was worried about violence, Trump acknowledged that it would only happen if he loses, which sounds an awful lot like a threat. Joining me now is Robert Kagan, Washington Post editor at large, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and author of Rebellion, How Anti-Liberalism is Tearing America Apart Again, which was published today. A timely book. We're going to talk about it shortly, but I want to talk about this Time interview. If I had one criticism of it, Robert, it was the way that they placed Donald Trump's plans, including letting states monitor women's abortions, monitor women's, I guess, menstrual cycles. I don't know how they would do that. And they placed it against, well, here are all the legislative barriers to that, as if there would be legislative barriers, as if there would be some sort of normal functioning democracy with him as president. What did you make of the interview and the revelations therein?
Well, I'm sorry, I have to admit, I haven't read the interview, although I've seen the quotes that came out of it and what you just read. And I think there is a general tendency, unfortunately, in this country to just assume that because our system has been functioning, because the institutions have been operating for many years, that they will save us ultimately. But I think the founders of the Republic could have told us that it isn't the institutions by themselves. The people have to act correctly. The people have to understand what threat exists right now from Donald Trump in terms of becoming a dictator. They spoke of the need for virtue, and by which they meant the people rising up to protect our system against a dictator. I don't mean rising up illegally. I mean rising up electorally, forcing congressmen to do the right thing, etc. So I think we can be very passive sometimes and just hope that the institutions will save us, but I think that's a mistake.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just going to put up a limited list of the things that Trump has said he would do in 2025. Mass layoffs of civil servants and replacing them with loyalists, terminating the Constitution, politicizing the DOJ to investigate his political adversaries, bomb Mexico, shoot migrants, electrify the wall, no two-state solution in the Middle East, end birthright citizenship, revoke student visas for ceasefire protesters, reinstate and expand the Muslim ban, gut the EPA, exit the Paris Climate Accords, a national ban on trans care for minors, punishing hospitals that provide any transgender care, teaching what he calls patriotic education, terminate the Department of Education. I could go on. Allowing states to punish women as they see fit, enforce the Comstock Act to ban abortion nationwide. I mean, everything he has in here, shoot shoplifters, federal takeovers of Democratic cities. And people hear that, see that, read that, and say, I want that. What should we make of that?
Well, he was right at the end of, I guess it was, I don't know, it was the end of that interview, but it was the end of your quotations when he was asked, you know, what does he think about, you know, violating the Constitution, et cetera, and calling yourself dictator of a day. And he said, the people like it. And I think that's a very important point that we are not focusing enough on. This isn't just about Donald Trump. He does have a very powerful, very mobilized constituency that is fundamentally seeking to overthrow the fundamental liberal system that the founders created. They oppose it. They oppose it because they think that their view of the nation, they have an ethno-religious definition of the nation. For them, the nation is a white Christian. For some of them, it's a white Protestant nation. This is an old strain in American history, after all. This didn't just pop up. It's just what's happened now is that these people who've always been around, they were part of the John Birch Society, they were part of the McCarthy movement, they were in the South during the slave years, they were in the South during the Jim Crow years. But now, for the first time, certainly in many decades, they've taken control of one of the political parties, and they have a leader who is essentially determined to destroy the system for his own purposes. But what they see is the opportunity to change the system in a way that is more to their liking and therefore not consistent with what the founders intended.
Well, and they've corrupted, you know, this sort of ethos has corrupted the Supreme Court, right? I mean, I detect a desire to institute a kind of religious diktat over the country from people like Samuel Alito. And you know, I've talked about it repealing the 20th century as being a core goal of MAGAism. It feels like what offends them is that the 20th century made, and you talk about this in your book, what the Constitution sort of prescribed as a kind of small L liberalism, right, where there's individual liberty. The 20th century is the great American century because it actually made that more real for women, for workers, for, you know, what used to be child laborers, for people of color, for immigrants, for black people. And they are offended by it, by the whole 20th century.
That's right. And it's important to separate that from what they talk about. They're upset about wokeness. But, you know,
right,
people were upset about wokeness back in the civil rights era, too.
Yeah.
There were many whites who were upset about the civil rights movement, and they regarded it as the wokeness of their time. So it's really true that it is the fundamental elements of our system that they're opposed to, even though they want to say that that's an excess of wokeness. And I just think we need to understand that it isn't just the whims of Donald Trump. And you know, one of the reasons that he's talking the way he talks is that his most reliable group of supporters are what I think you can't have a better word for them than white nationalists. He ran in his first campaign, people don't remember, I think, back in 2011 when he was his first run for the presidency, he ran on a one issue, which was birtherism, which was basically to say that the first American, black American president was not really an American. And in so doing, he signaled to those people that he was their representative. And they have basically chosen him as their leader. And they are essential to him because as he goes through these court trials, as he faces the various pressures that he faces in the system, he can't rely on your average, you know, Mitt Romney voting Republican. He has to rely on these hardcore white nationalists, in some cases white Christian nationalists, who are sticking with him no matter what, no matter what happens in the trials.
And this is the book. We're going to talk more about it on the other side of the break, because I want to get into some of your thesis, which is really about these people saying that they are the super patriots, but how they fundamentally disagree with the founders on what the system is. You talk about that in this book. We're going to do that on the other side of the break. Robert Kagan will be right back with us. Stay right there.
I cannot in good conscience endorse Donald Trump in this campaign.
I think there's a lot to be concerned about. I've said I believe he's a threat to democracy, and we should be very mindful of that.
I think it's important for people to understand that they are rolling the dice on a second Trump term.
Robert Kagan is back with me. He's the author of Rebellion, How Anti-Liberalism is Tearing America Apart Again. Those were three Republicans, Mike Pence, Mark Esper, former defense secretary, and John Bolton, said they won't vote for Trump. But a lot of Republicans will sit back and let him come back in and or either be passive about it or actively vote for him again. In this book, you draw a line between the kind of straight line from the slaveholding South through the 1920s, which you and I agree is the era we're kind of reliving. Talk about that and why so many Republicans will go along.
Well, why so many Republicans go along is an interesting question. I mean, there's obviously the professional Republican class, which is basically people like Bill Barr, who I think are basically cowards and they don't want to be expelled from the Republican community, even though Barr has said very negative things about Donald Trump. But as far as your average Republican voter, why don't, you know, I don't believe anymore that people don't see the threat that Donald Trump poses. He makes it clear every single day the kind of threat that he poses. So if people are willing to support him, you can only conclude that they're just not, they don't care. Yeah. You know, and I think that, you know, unfortunately, for a lot of white Americans, I think that they don't think that whatever Donald Trump is going to be doing is going to be aimed at them. And after all, he's talking about the poisoning the blood and using the military against immigrants. And he's always divided America between white people and particularly white males and everybody mm-hmm. else. And so I think if you're in that category or if you're a rich guy like Jamie Dimon, who basically endorsed Donald Trump at Davos, it's because you think you're going to be okay. It's depressing to think that way. But as I note in the book, you know, both Jefferson and Lincoln and others very much worried about precisely this, that the necessary sort of commitment to liberal values, which is to say the values of protecting individual rights and the idea of universal rights, that commitment can waver over time. It did waver when Lincoln gives his famous Lyceum speech in 1838. You know, there was violence all over the place, and it was clear that the system was breaking down. And he lamented the loss of those values. And of course, within two decades, you had the Civil War. And I do feel that we're in a very similar place right now, where people have forgotten, you know, what it is that makes our liberty special, what makes the country special. And it is the principles of the Declaration of Independence, which I believe Trump and a significant portion of his movement are hostile to.
And why the 20s do you focus on it so much in this book?
Well, you know, one of the great things that we've, I think, to some extent covered over in our history is the nature of the 1920s. You know, we think of it as the Jazz Age.
The flapper era.
Right. And you have those boring Republican presidents that nobody can think of, Silent Cal, et cetera.
Right.
It also happened to be a time of sort of peak racism in the United States, and not just race, you know, peak religious bigotry, et cetera. The second Ku Klux Klan was widespread. And by the way, a very legitimate organization. Politicians were happy to be members of the Klan back in that day. And then there was also this thing that I was talking about that's been covered over. The eugenics movement was very powerful in the United States. And they didn't just make distinction between whites and blacks and other non-white peoples. They made distinctions between white people, Nordic race and the Mediterranean race, etc. So that was a very bad time. And you know what? There are very important figures in the Trump world who say explicitly that they want to go back to the 1920s.
You and I are both obsessed with the same era, sir. this book is you are speaking my inner thoughts with this, Robert Kagan. I believe everyone should read this book. It is super important. Y'all need to, if you don't know the 20s, you don't know this era. Thank you, sir. Robert Kagan. Much appreciated. Best of luck with the book. Coming up, pro-Palestinian and anti-war protests and the response to them has continued to escalate, with Columbia students now occupying an administrative building. A live report from that campus next. Protests over Israel's war in Gaza continue to roil university campuses nationwide, as Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu says Israel will launch a military campaign against Rafah even with a ceasefire deal. At Columbia University in New York, protesters occupied a building overnight, flying a Palestinian flag from Hamilton Hall. Columbia warned students to stay away from campus today. The university also began suspending students who defied an order to leave their pro-Palestinian encampment by Monday's deadline. Across the country, hundreds of students have been arrested after college presidents called police, some in riot gear and some carrying tear gas. That is certainly the case at the University of Texas in Austin and Washington University in St. Louis, where the school has threatened students with expulsion and arrests. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch reports that students are houseless and professors are unclear about their jobs after they were barred from Washington University's campus following an anti-war protest that ended in mass arrests. Joining me now is NBC News correspondent Antonia Hilton near the Columbia campus. Antonia, give me the latest.
Hey, Joy. Well, the question that is on everyone's mind right now is what's about to happen here. This building is Hamilton Hall right behind me. There are about 60 people inside. Students tell me they think some students are there, but we just heard from the NYPD and the mayor that their belief is that there are what they called anarchists, non-affiliates, people who are not students, almost professional agitators who found their way into the protests and into this building last night. And the NYPD is waiting to see if Columbia is going to give them permission to enter. And if they do, the people inside that building, if they're students, are facing expulsion, but likely worse, potentially felony charges, trespassing, and more. And so students, faculty, I've been getting texts from professors for the last several hours who are all very worried about what might happen to students. Students who aren't even just in those buildings, who might be nearby or protesting on the steps close to Hamilton Hall. There is fear right now of what could physically happen to the campus community. And, you know, a lot of people on all sides of this issue, from the Jewish students who have felt at times unsafe here on campus to pro-Palestinian students and faculty, the one thing they seem to agree on, Joy, is that this is the fault of the administration, that at some point the negotiations, the conversations should have reached some kind of solution. We saw Brown, for example, today. They closed their encampment because the school agreed to go to a vote to discuss the possibility of divestment, to at least show the students that they were going to consider these measures. Then, of course, we've seen the other end of the spectrum, which is just an immediate and almost constant police response at other schools. So the question here for people on all sides at Columbia is, how is the administration going to handle this tonight, and what is about to happen, Joy?
Yeah, absolutely. We've also seen UPenn and the New School. Other schools have handled it very differently. NBC News, NBC's Antonia Hilton, thank you. If anything happens, wave your hands and we will come back to you. Thank you so much. Let's bring in Andrew De La Salas, a student at Washington University in St. Louis, who was arrested for protesting on Saturday. Tell us what happened to you, Andrew.
Well, in short, I was arrested on my own campus. I was held in custody for 6 hours. I wasn't provided water or food, and I've since been suspended and banned from my own campus. That's what happened.
And what were you charged with?
I was charged with trespassing.
So were you suspended before they issued the trespassing charge?
I was suspended about 6 hours after receiving notice of my trespassing charge.
So essentially they suspended you and then said you no longer have a right to be on the campus and then charged you with trespassing.
They first charged me with trespassing, and then I received notice of my suspension the following morning.
Now, tell me why you were protesting. What was the ask of the people that you were protesting with?
Yes, our demands were very clear. It was for the university to divest from Boeing. Boeing is a weapons manufacturer. It has factories in the St. Louis area, and the university has maintained its relationship with the manufacturer, despite student union passing a resolution opposing the university's relationship, despite multiple protests, despite walkouts, despite art installations. This was a continuation of the protests of the university's relationship with Boeing, because we can find those bomb fragments in the homes of Palestinians in central Gaza.
And what was the university's response to, did you all request negotiations? Did you want to talk to them?
Well, when we were establishing the encampment, some elected officials showed up and they said that they would speak with the administrators. We asked them if they're going to be there, they might as well advocate for us. And Dr. Jill Stein and two members of the Board of Alders for St. Louis attempted to speak with administrators, but our Dean of Students and other administrators refused to speak with us, refused to speak with the electeds. And actually, they remained behind police lines, lounging in an armchair with their hands behind their head. And they did so as five police departments swept the camp and brutalized as many our neighbors, my friends, our protesters, all of us together.
Were you surprised at how violent the reaction was? Because we've seen this sort of repeated at campus after campus, and each university doesn't seem to be changing the tactics. Were you surprised that the arrests were pretty violent?
I'll say that I'm disappointed in the behavior of the administrators, especially as somebody who has had the opportunity to sit down for dinner with the chancellor, meet his family, discuss my story, learn about what drives him to be a leader. But my story and the stories of the other people on the protests and the stories of all of those coming out of Gaza were enough to prevent them from sending in those police departments.
Very quickly, what happens to you next? Do you have legal representation? What do you do now?
Fortunately, the St. Louis community is incredibly strong. Many of the arrestees have been, we've been in discussion about potential legal support and other resources, especially for the folks that have been evicted from their homes on campus.
Andrew De La Salas, thank you very much. Please keep in touch with us so we can follow up with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And coming up next, securing the youth and minority vote is imperative for President Biden to win in November, which is why Vice President Harris is on a tour highlighting the administration's investment in minority and underserved communities. That's next. Vice President Kamala Harris was on the campaign trail on Monday. The vice president visited Atlanta to kick off a nationwide economic opportunity tour, highlighting Biden administration investments in underserved and minority communities.
The work that we have been doing over the last 3 years has been focused on all of these areas and also understanding the context in which we exist, which is the longstanding disparities. And understanding that in spite of those who in certain parts of our country want to attack DEI, we understand that you can't truly invest in the strength of our nation if you don't pay attention to diversity, equity, and inclusion.
And it came as pro-Palestinian and anti-Atlanta Cop City protesters returned to Emory University's campus. And as police at the University of Georgia in Athens arrested 16 protesters for trespassing over an encampment there. Vice President Harris will continue her push on economic opportunity next week with a visit to Detroit. Joining me now is Bakari Sellers, civil rights attorney and author of the new book, The Moment. Thoughts on the race reckoning that wasn't and how we can all move forward now. Bakari, my friend, it is good to see you crossing the divide to come over to the other camp for just a moment. Here's the book. I want my copy signed. But let's talk about Kamala Harris for just a moment. You're a political strategist as well as an author. The sort of deployment of her now, particularly to the South and to college campuses, and especially now when you're seeing these campuses roiled by pro-Palestinian protests, what do you make of it?
It's necessary, and I think that her voice is necessary, and I think that her message is necessary. And sometimes, and I think we're going to see this as we look forward to Joe Biden coming to Morehouse College's campus, it's not necessarily the message, but it's the messenger. And I feel like she's being very well received on these particular campuses. Look, these campuses have a history of protest, and I'm someone who decries law enforcement involvement on college campuses because, as I talk about in the moment and I've talked about in My Vanishing Country, my father was shot by law enforcement on a college campus. And so while I understand the balance of the rise of anti-Semitism, I understand the fact that we don't need to see another baby being killed in Gaza. I understand the outcry of these protesters. What I don't want is someone like Eric Adams using this as another opportunity to have a light or another badge or another just opportunity to smile in front of a camera and integrate law enforcement on college campuses, because we've seen from South Carolina State, February 8th, 1968, to Jackson State, to Kent State, that simply does not mix. What I do appreciate, though, is this administration sending Kamala Harris to these places to at least have these conversations.
Do you think that the Morehouse visit will be as well received?
I'm interested to see what happens. And what I want to see from Joe Biden, and again, the shameless plug of this book as I'm over here talking to you, and I love you, by the way, Joy, I don't want Joe Biden to pigeonhole Black men. I don't want him just to spend, dozens of minutes talking about criminal justice reform as if all we want to do is stay out of jail or make sure our loved ones are out of jail. What I would like for him to talk about is his vision for peace throughout the world. What I want him to talk about is his vision for voting rights. What I want him to talk about is the role that Bakari Sellers and other Black men can play to ensure that my wife, Ellen, my daughter, Kai, my other daughter, Sadie, have, you know, just the ability to make their own decisions when it comes to reproductive rights, because there is a role for us to play. If he gets up there and to steal just a soundbite from one of my good friends, Brittany, if he gets up there and talks about criminal justice reform for 20 minutes, I'm going to riot myself.
Yeah. Let's talk about this book, because, I mean, you come from a civil rights legacy family. Obviously, you talked about your father who was on these campuses protesting back in the day. And you also come from a political background. What should people know about this racial reckoning that didn't happen? What will people learn from this book?
What I want people to realize is a very sobering reflection of where we are. And maybe it was my youthful naivete, but I believe that, you know, around 2020 with the murders of Ahmaud, Breonna and George and COVID, I felt like we were on the precipice of change. I felt like there was going to be an understanding and empathy, maybe a third reconstruction, understanding what Black folk were going through in this construct, in this period in time. And we missed that moment. And not only did we miss it, but I'd articulate that we're going backwards. And so as a millennial parent who has to go out here and raise children, raise Black children, the moment started when I was actually crying on my network on TV, just trying to tell people and help them understand what it meant to be Black in this country. It went viral. What I want people to understand from this book is that we've made progress in this country, but we still have yet a ways to go. And so it's not just a reflection of where we are, but we also have prescriptions of how we move forward. You may not agree with them all, but at least I want people to get off the sidelines and begin to have a conversation.
You have a daughter, a beautiful daughter. And, you know, we live in a world where your daughter has fewer rights than I did when I was born, than your mom did, you know, by the 1970s. And you have the whole South now locked in abortion bans. And at the same time, you have referenda in Florida for not just restoring abortion rights, but even restoring, you know, legalizing weed. There is this sort of push pull that rights seem to be slipping away and coming back. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about where we are?
I'm real about where we are. And in the book, I articulate the fact that as a millennial parent, I may be a parent. I realize it's a difficult pill to swallow that we may be the first generation that does not improve the plight of the next generation. And, you know, my father gave me something better than I inherited. And I realized that I may not be able to do that for my own children. That's a tough pill to swallow. I realize that we're in the nadir. I mean, Joy, we're in a dark place. But I think King said it best, only when it's darkest can you see the stars. I believe in this next generation, and I just simply want Sadie and Stokely and Kai to have a better tomorrow than they have a yesterday.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you have, again, you have a daughter and a son, but there is this sort of meme right now that says that Black men are falling out of politics, pulling away, not just from the Democratic Party, but from participation at all. Do you believe that that is true?
Yes. And I have a dedicated whole chapter in My Vanishing Country. I talk about Black women a lot and give them their flowers while they're living, as they should. But Black men for a very long period of time have not been listened to in this process. It's a clarion call. The lights are blinking. I mean, whether or not we meet them where they are and have these conversations and listen to Black male voters, I don't think, and I may differ from some of the analysts that come on, but this is not a race between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. This is a race between Joe Biden and Donald Trump in the couch. And there is a high probability that Black folk, particularly Black men, will stay at home if we do not have. And this is, I am speaking directly to white progressives. Like, look, it's not about race neutral policies, race specific solutions for race specific problems.
This is the book. Y'all pick this up and read it so that you can understand where we are now. This is one of the brightest brothers out there. Bakari Sellers, thank you, my friend. That is tonight's readout.